Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is the Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of April 9th, 2010. Now, sure, we all love getting a check in the mail from Uncle Sam at this time of year, but according to your friendly neighborhood economist, sometimes that's just plain irrational.
When you receive a tax refund, that's money that you could have been getting in your paycheck all throughout the previous year.
Oh, that's right. Well, we'll explore why we adore those rebates so much. And yes, it can be hard to find a good accountant, but in China, you have to choose the lesser of some pretty gnarly evils.
Not all of them are honest. You know, there is a lot of corruption in the Chinese system. They, you know, sometimes will request special payments.
Those stories are coming up. But first, the tax man cometh. No, really. Here on this very show, we figured, what better way to help you with that looming April 15th deadline than to bring in the IRS commissioner himself, Doug Shulman. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tess.
So how'd your taxes go this year? Are you all done?
I'm all done, yes.
And are you a refund guy? You like getting that check back?
I try to pay just on the dime, not too much, not too little.
Well, of course, that's what we in personal finance always advise. So you have said publicly that you don't do your own taxes. What do you think that says about our tax code that even you need help?
You know, this is something that's gotten a bunch of attention. Let me be clear what I said. It's not that I don't do my own taxes. It's that I've used a preparer for many years. And so what that means is somebody organizes my information for me because I'm very busy, sends it to me, and then I spend a lot of time going line by line with that person over my taxes. And as IRS commissioner, I'm fully accountable and responsible for making sure I pay every single cent I owe.
So do you like your accountant, and can I have his number?
Absolutely. I love him. He's great. He was a referral. I won't put his name out over the air.
Okay, fair enough. The taxpayer advocate told Congress that the IRS needs more manpower, and I'm sure you would always like to have more folks helping you out. Back in January, your agency said that it hoped to answer about 70% of the calls to its helpline. Any improvements?
Yeah, we answer well above 70% of the phone calls that come in. This year, it's maybe 1% of the people only during peak times are getting a busy signal. I mean, my goal is to answer every call immediately. We don't have the resources to do that, but if people are willing to wait on the line a little bit during the busy seasons, they'll get an answer from the IRS and they'll get an accurate answer.
I am told that the IRS has also taken a few steps to be more of a nice guy in light of what's going on with the economy. How are you implementing those changes?
We have a couple new programs. There's always been a program where if you can't meet basic living expenses and you have a tax debt, you can settle your debt for less than 100%.
Mm-hmm.
The old rules were we looked at your last 3 years' average income to determine if you could pay. We recognize some people lost their jobs, so they might have had a high income before, but they still can't pay. So we changed the rules this year and said we're just going to look at your current income. We also are having 1,000 Saturday open houses where anyone who's got an issue with the IRS that is unresolved can call, make an appointment. We'll make sure all the right people are there, whether it's a collection person or an exam person. And our goal is to totally resolve your issues so you can walk away feeling like you don't have something lingering and hanging over your head.
What would be your main piece of advice this weekend for folks who are rushing to get things done by Thursday?
First of all, you should electronically file and get a direct deposit. If you do, you'll get your refund within 10 days. Second is, even if you can't pay everything you owe, file a return and then give us a call or attach a note to the return and we can work through issues with people, put them on an installment agreement, work them through a settlement. The last thing people want to do is disappear.
All right. And because I do have you here on the show, I have to ask you, what's it like being the tax man?
Well, it's great for me. The misconception about the IRS is that we wake up every day and the only thing we do is show up at people's houses or write them a letter and say, pay up. The reality is, you know, we serve hundreds of millions of people every year. We run a big, complex operation. So I think of myself like the CEO of a big financial service institution that needs to keep the machine up and running, needs to serve people, and then needs to do our collection job.
Anything surprisingly fun about that title? I don't know, people come up to you and sing that Beatles tune?
Everybody loves the Beatles tune, and I love the Beatles. So yeah, we try to keep it going around here during tax time.
Doug Shulman is the IRS commissioner. Thanks so much, and happy tax season to you.
Thank you, Tess.
All right, raise your hand if you're one of those waiting to the last minute to file your taxes. I can't see you, but I can feel you. Why do today what you could put off till tomorrow, right? Well, the tomorrows are in short supply at this point. So what if I told you that the government could do it all for you? Julie Small reports on a program here in California that does just that.
California dreamed up the idea a few years ago. Why not take information the state franchise tax board gets from employers? You know, the stuff on your W-2 and 1099 forms from your bank, and have the board fill out your state return for you. The program's called Ready Return, and it's up and running.
Actually, I received a notification in the mail that gave me my code number.
25-year-old Colleen Odell tried out Ready Return this year. The state franchise tax board notified some people like her directly to spread the word about the program. But most Californians have to check the tax board's website to see if they're eligible. Odell says if you are, you're in for a treat.
And it was pretty simple as an ABCD. It kind of gave you the simple steps.
Odell reviewed her state-generated Ready Return online, checked it against her own records, and signed off. It only took 15 minutes, and Odell saved $65 she would have paid a tax preparer.
This was actually the first year that I didn't pay somebody to perform my taxes for me. I actually did it on my own, and I feel confident that I was able to do it.
Ready Return saves California money, too. The state would have spent $2.50 to process Odell's paper return, but California spends less than 40 cents to process the Ready Return.
We're onto something here.
That's State Controller John Chung. He heads California's tax board.
When you have an easy program, when your friends talk about the program, when they're not afraid of looking at all the different numbers or their forms, you know, you have one easy form, then it encourages people to file.
Chung can't use Ready Return because his taxes are too complicated. The program's limited to single filers or heads of household who get income only from wages and only from one employer. You can't take itemized deductions, you can't have more than five dependents, and you are allowed one tax credit. In California, that tax situation applies to about 2 million people. But last year, only 60,000 of those taxpayers used the program. Controller Chung blames the stingy $10,000 budget he has to advertise Ready Return. This year, that paid for flyers and posters. But tax expert James Mall thinks Californians snub Ready Return for a reason.
They got the thing and they never turned it back in because it was a mess. They just realized this is not really my return. This is the first 5 minutes of my return.
Mall teaches tax law at Villanova University in Pennsylvania. He says the government can't know all the complicated details of a person's life that changed tax liabilities. So people will do one of two things. Either check the government's math, in which case, why not just file your own tax return? Or they'll take the government's word for it and maybe pass up credits or deductions they could have qualified for.
It's not really saving very many people much work, except that it will take advantage of what I call inertia on the other side. And that is people say, well, the government did this, it must be okay.
California is the only state that offers pre-filled tax returns, but other states are thinking about the idea, and so is President Obama. In fact, Obama's leading economic advisor, Austin Goolsbee, came up with a federal version of the Ready Return. President Obama wants to adopt what they call Simple Return. It's aimed at 40% of Americans who file straightforward federal returns. That's about 53 million people. Goolsbee estimates that would save taxpayers 225 million hours of time and $2 billion a year in tax preparer fees and tax preparation software. The Computer and Communications Industry Association hates the idea. The trade group includes tax preparation software companies like TurboTax Maker, Intuit. President Ed Black says taxpayers should hate it, too.
The incentives are clearly there for the government to maximize revenue and for the private sector to maximize taxpayer awareness of the benefits and credits that are available to them.
And there's a logistical problem. Last year, the IRS said the simple return isn't feasible because employers don't send the Fed's W-2 data early enough in the year. But that could be changed if the political will existed. Sacramento taxpayers Bridget Bagney, Rajpal Singh, and Barbara Fontaine say, bring it on.
I would actually welcome any simplification of the process because there's really no getting out of it one way or the other.
That is good. And I'm going to do it if they allow me to do this.
Yes, I'm ready. I'm ready. I need all the help I can get.
President Obama's Economic Recovery Advisory Board plans to consider return-free tax filing, along with a bunch of other proposals to simplify the U.S. tax code later this year. That means for now, everyone's stuck with filling out the federal forms, even here in California. I'm Julie Small for Marketplace Money.
Whether your taxes are simple or complicated, bizarre tax rituals abound at this time of year. We asked people around the country to tell us what they go through as April 15th draws nigh.
My name is Leslie Helgeson, and I live in Mayville, North Dakota. We teach at a university, and so we sit down during spring break and sort out our receipts that we've stashed in paper sacks all year. And then we like to rent a bunch of movies on a certain theme. This year, we followed a World War II theme. So we rented Band of Brothers, which was an HBO series, and we stay up late and, you know, have snacks all we want and just have that whole week together. It's kind of like a little ritual we plan every year.
I am Gary Halbert. I've been preparing taxes for 23 years in Mobile, Alabama. Some people come in very prepared and very astute. Some people just don't care. They all worry about that later and worry about life today. They come in with shoeboxes or grocery bags. And so really what they're doing is they're causing themselves to create a larger tax bill because we have to do a lot more to get the records organized in order to prepare their return.
My name is Robert Venegas from Cottonwood, Arizona. Tax time every year, the first thing I think is that I need to get the children out of my wife's hair so that she can do the taxes. I take the kids out and we'll normally go shopping anywhere between 2 and 4.5 hours. And the kids have a game that they like to play when the stores are crowded, where they grab each other by the arms and swing around in circles. It's just flailing the mass of bodies. And as they start acting up, I picture my wife at home with her feet up on the computer with a cocktail. And it makes me wonder who's getting the better end of the deal here.
That was Leslie Helgeson, Gary Talbert, and Robert Venegas. Coming up, some insight into our brains on taxes, including how we use that refund check to keep our finances in check.
When we get the refund, we have this amount saved up that then we can use to do things that maybe we wouldn't have been able to do on our own.
That's next on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Every year they appear like weeds in a spring garden. The line of cars at the post office on April 15th. These are the stubborn folks who wait till the last minute to mail their taxes. But not everyone waits. If you're getting a refund, you filed a long time ago to get your grubby little hands on that check from Uncle Sam. But that means that last year you gave him an interest-free loan, which prompts us to ask...
Let me start with question number one. What the hell were you thinking?
What were you thinking? It's our ongoing look at why we do what we do with our money. Well, refund fans have something going on in their brains that folks like Bill Congdon like to study. He's with the Brookings Institution and wrote recently about incorporating behavioral finance into tax policy. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, and thanks for having me.
Finish your taxes yet?
I have not, actually, no.
You have not. Well, are you expecting to owe or get a refund?
I will likely owe.
What was your thinking behind that math?
Having been trained in economics, my thinking comes from the standard sort of way economists think about tax refunds, which is that they are a kind of mistake. That when you receive a tax refund, that's money that you could have been getting in your paycheck all throughout the previous year.
Right. And you've described this as a great example of irrational economic behavior, of people basically giving the government an interest-free loan. Yet, so many of us, myself included, love getting a refund. What are we thinking?
There's evidence that what we're thinking is that this is a way that we can save some money that we might otherwise not have the self-control or the willpower to save. That if we were getting that money in our paychecks every week, we would spend it on things we wouldn't even notice, extra cups of coffee, that sort of thing.
Right.
But if we let that extra money slide off to Uncle Sam, it'll be sort of out of sight, out of mind. And those temptation problems won't arise because we won't have the money. And then when we get the refund, we have this amount saved up that then we can use to do things that maybe we wouldn't have been able to do on our own.
And it's no small amount of money either.
No, the average refund among returns that got a refund in recent years has been north of $2,000.
$2,000?
Yes.
Do you have any notion of what most people use it for?
Yes, and that's part of the reason why we think what people are doing is sort of saving with their refund. There's evidence that people take that money and they will save it. They will use it to pay down debt, or they will use it to buy durable consumer goods, like a new appliance, or use it as a down payment on a car.
And isn't there just something as basic as pain and pleasure going on here? I mean, who wouldn't rather get a paycheck deposited into their checking account rather than writing a check to Uncle Sam for some amount that you owe, even if it's not a lot and you've actually done the math well so that you're kind of where you're supposed to be? You just don't want to give him more of your money, right?
Absolutely. And there are a number of behavioral tendencies that point people in that direction. The first is just that you might not notice the amount of money that it's being withheld out of your paycheck every month. So there's literally no pain to you
right.
for the gain of getting the refund later. The other behavioral aspect to that is exactly what you said. People really, really hate having to pay money. They feel the pain of having to pay $100 greater than the pleasure of getting an extra $100.
So what do you tell yourself when you're writing that check?
What I have told myself in the past, before I started studying behavioral economics and how it applied to taxes more, was that I was acting as a rational economic agent. It is an annual point of contention in my household, however, because I married a refund person.
Uh-oh.
It's not that big a point of contention. But the interesting thing about it is I'm starting to think that my wife might be right.
She's going to want to be sure to listen.
And yes, it shouldn't surprise me at all. But looking at and thinking about it from a behavioral perspective, maybe that would force me to save extra money. And maybe I would be able to use that refund and put it toward savings or something else that I wouldn't otherwise have saved up to do.
So your W-4 is going to be all different this year.
It might.
Bill Congdon is a research director in economics at the Brookings Institution. Thanks for dissecting our brains when it comes to refunds.
Thank you.
And joining me now to answer some of your questions is our economics editor, Chris Farrell. So, Chris, have you done your taxes yet?
Yes, I have done my taxes.
And where do you come down on this whole refund versus pay Uncle Sam question?
Well, Tess, I don't think it's going to surprise you that I've been influenced by economists.
Really?
So I'm writing a check.
You are writing a check.
But I've gotten a refund in the past. Not a big one, mm-hmm. but a refund. And it does feel good.
It does. I mean,
Yes.
I know it makes no rational sense to give Uncle Sam this interest-free loan, as we were talking about, but I would so much rather have him send me money.
Well, think of it this way, Tess. Over the past year, how much interest have you made on your savings? So I'm not so sure you lost any money with an interest-free loan if you do get a refund.
Right, yeah. It's like 0.3% or something like that. So. All right. So quick, give us like your top three best things for folks to do with their refund. Sensible or perhaps not so sensible?
All right. Well, one would be season tickets to concerts or theater.
If you have
a little less money, I love seltzer water. I love seltzer water. So I want to get myself a seltzer water maker so that I stop buying seltzer water. So I think that would save me some money over the long run and be a little bit green. And my last thing, if I got a really small refund, padded bike shorts. I just learned that the hard way over the past 2 or 3 days that they're a good thing to wear.
All right. Well, that's borderline TMI. So let's go to the phones. You know someone who could always use a little extra money?
Who?
A small business owner like Charlotte, who is calling from Reston, Virginia. Hi, Charlotte.
Hi. How are you?
Very well. And it says here that you are a cheesemaker.
Yes, I am. Well, I'm an aspiring cheesemaker. I'm a home cheesemaker right now, but I'm looking to branch out.
Well, this is so funny because you are the second mid-Atlantic cheesemaker we've had on the show in the last few months. What is it with cheesemakers and public radio?
I don't know.
Well, tell us a little bit about your cheese.
Well, I do goat cheese and cow's milk cheeses. Currently, all the cheeses I make are made from raw milk that I actually drive out to a farm to pick up myself.
And are you just doing this in your regular house kitchen?
Exactly. I'm doing it in my house, in my kitchen right now, and I can't legally sell it because I'm not inspected by the state, and there are all these hoops you have to jump through, so I really need to, you know, find a place, like a commercial kitchen, where I could actually make my cheese in order to sell it. So.
Well, then how are you financing this dream if you're not making any money off of it?
Well, that's my question for you, is how do I finance such a thing? Because my first original question was that my husband and I currently have a certain amount of debt. Some of that is his student loans and some of it is credit card debt, and our total debt is about $60,000. My first question was about debt consolidation, and then my second question was if it is like absolutely absurd to try and start a small business when you already have so much outside debt.
Oh, these are great questions.
Well, so Chris, first of all, let's deal with the debt consolidation question. And so she says $60,000. Charlotte, how much of that is student loans and how much is credit cards?
It is going to be about $25,000 in student loans, and then the rest is all credit card debt.
Are these federally issued or are these private student loans?
They were from the state of Pennsylvania, so they're, yeah.
Okay, so you should have a lot of flexibility what you can do with them. One of the things that you may want to investigate is consolidating those loans. And also, if cash flow is really important, you may want to consider even stretching out these payments so that you're paying less up front. Now, the trade-off when you do this, if you're paying less up front, you pay more over a longer period of time. But there is no prepayment penalty with student loans. So you may want to buy yourself a little bit of time now to get at, say, that credit card debt. And then when you're in a better financial position, then you just get more aggressive about those student loans.
And what about the credit card debt? We hear lots of advertising these days about debt consolidation, most of that revolving around credit cards. Is this ever a good idea?
It's probably almost never a good idea. I guess every once in a while it works out. But here's the real truth, Tess. Whoever's doing a debt consolidation at this point, my guess is going to be more costly over a longer period of time with a lot of fees.
Okay. Now, Charlotte, you had another question as well, which is whether you should be starting a small business with all this debt still on the books, right?
Right.
Chris, can I ask a practical question on Charlotte's behalf?
Sure.
It sounds like you don't have just a cash cushion somewhere, right?
No.
So, Chris, what's the likelihood that she would even get any sort of loan to buy a small business, even to get some retail space, if they've got all this debt already?
They're not going to get a loan. And the fact is, most small businesses don't get loans. They actually start out with various forms of equity and deals. You give up some of the profit in order not to have the debt burden. But at the same time, somebody is also taking a risk on you.
So, Charlotte, will you send us some of your initial commercial product?
Sure. Yeah. Once I'm up and running, I would love to.
All right. A little sample would be great. Yeah. We'll give you our address.
Great.
Thanks for the call.
Thanks.
No crackers, Gromit. We've forgotten the crackers.
All right, Chris, next up we have James from Middlesex, Vermont. And James, you're a small businessman too, in a sense, aren't you?
Yes, I am. I'm a freelance journalist.
Yeah. So how long have you been doing that?
Just under 2 years, actually, now.
Uh-huh. And what did you do before that?
I was a home builder, a contract construction manager.
Oh, well, we know what happened there, don't we?
No, actually, for me, I jumped out early, had the money, and I decided I'd go back to school and study journalism. And so I got out long before they kicked me out, I guess.
Oh, nice. Well, so you got out of one dying industry to get into journalism?
Another dying industry, yes. And in Vermont, there's not a lot of opportunities for journalists, which is why I'm freelance.
And you know, before we hear from the Home Builders Association, I know that building is not a dying industry, okay? But
tell us the next industry you're going into so we know which ones to avoid.
Yeah, there we go.
Yeah, exactly.
And you said that you were prepared when you left the building industry. It sounds like you had a little money socked away.
Yeah. We're me and my wife are pretty savvy when it comes to finances.
Well, then why are you calling us?
Well, actually, because we always find in all of our reading and our magazines, it always stops at the what to do first level, but it never gets beyond the what to do after you've done all the first levels. And that's kind of where we always feel. We always complain like, okay, but now we've got our 6 month savings and we've got our, you know, we've started investing and our mortgage is getting paid off and we're debt, you know, we don't have any credit card debt. Now what do we do? and it never gets to that. So that was sort of why we sent the question.
Well, good for you, first of all. So you say you've got an emergency fund, you're paying down your mortgage.
Yeah.
So what kind of second tier question can we answer for you?
Well, we started in, investing in stocks last year.
Ah.
March 19th, nonetheless.
Whoa, right after the market hit bottom then.
Right after, yeah, 7 days, I guess, something like that. So we've done really well in the market, and we've set up that we're going to invest and review our investments every 6 months.
Okay.
So come August of last year, we were doing well, and we said, okay, we had broad-based ETFs, and we decided we're going to start now taking sector ETFs.
Okay, before we go any further, Chris, can you help define an ETF for our audience?
Right. So this is an exchange-traded fund. You buy and sell it like a stock, but instead of being a company with employees and earnings, what goes into that stock is an index, and that index can be the Standard Poor's 500, the Dow Jones. And so ETF is one of the explosive growing parts of the market.
And in part, that is apparently because of James.
Well, we like it because it gives us, we don't have a lot of money, so it gives us diversity without having to take a lot of risk.
Absolutely. So you did well with them.
Yes. I mean, yeah, obviously. But our question is we bought a real estate, a mortgage ETF, and it hasn't moved in 8 months. And so we were wondering, we know that you're supposed to buy and hold and look long-term, but when is it actually a good idea to just sell and to move on to mm-hmm. another investment? Or are you really just supposed to buy and hold and look long-term and not do anything irrespective of what you've bought and why you bought it and what it's doing in the market?
Well, Chris, I think that's a question that should apply not only to underperforming, but also to his overperforming stocks, shouldn't it? This is a great question. How do you know when to buy and to sell and to hold?
When do you reap your gains?
Exactly.
I would look at this ETF that's gone nowhere. If I sold it, where would I put the money? Is there a better investment opportunity out there that excites me more, that I think has better prospects? Once you've identified what that better investment opportunity is, then I'd sell this one and put the money in something you think is better. Or to ask yourself, what is also your discipline of when you sell? One discipline that's very common, you know, once a stock or an ETF has gone down by 10% or 15%, whatever is the trigger, once it goes there, you sell it. You get out of that position. You limit your losses. And these are the kinds of things to do. And in terms of what reaping the gains is the same thing. The ones that have done the really big gains, you speculated. You did well. Maybe you should take some money off the table. And that's what I'd be doing, taking some off the table at least.
Yeah, Chris, this is really the religion that that Bill O'Neill preaches over at Investors Business Daily, right? That you have to set yourself a level of gain at which you're going to sell and a level of loss at which you're going to sell. I mean, a lot of people will do different percentages there, right?
People do different percentages. I say 10% is a classic one. In this kind of investing, limiting your losses is extremely important. You also want to pay attention to the tax season because there may be some selling that makes sense or some on either side, gains or losses make sense around tax time.
Okay. Well, that's great.
All right. So basically, I think this all comes down to, you know when to say when.
Yeah.
That's right.
Well, now that it's going up, I think we'll hold on to it, though, for a little while longer.
Right, but we've all learned that everything doesn't always go up, right?
No, it doesn't.
All right, thanks so much for the call, James.
Well, thank you guys very much.
Our money line is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, or you can write to us. You'll find the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. And we'll be back with more of your questions later in the show. And before we go to the break, one more bit of tax madness. Okay, it's not technically a tax, but did you hear the latest in airline fee hijinks? On Tuesday, Spirit Airlines decided it would be a simply terrific idea to also charge for carry-on luggage. Anything you put in that overhead bin? $45, please. Webster O'Brien, an airline consultant at SH&E, says this is just another step in the evolution of air travel.
It's very much the difference between a prefix menu and something that's a la carte, where
The consumer needs to choose what they want to pay for and identify what it is that's of value to them.
Right. And, of course, luggage is always optional when you travel long distances by plane. And then there's Ireland's Ryanair, which on Wednesday instituted what Vanity Fair dubbed a pay-per-pee system on its flights. So might want to think twice about that Starbucks before you board, unless you've got spare coin for the loo. Here's that airline's spokesman, Stephen McNamara.
If we get rid of two toilets off the aircraft, we can put in an extra six seats and thereby increase the number of passengers and reduce the overhead cost per passenger, which will ultimately lead to lower fares.
And there's where we get to the essence of ridiculousness in all these fees. We're paying extra for blankets, baggage, and bathrooms because we're obsessed with lower fares. Maybe we're the problem. There's cheating on your taxes, and then there's what happens in China, where they serve up fake receipts as a three-course meal.
Your typical Chinese business keeps multiple sets of books, the official one that they show to the government. They have the ones that they're willing to show any partners, and then they have the third one that's the real one because they have to manage their business.
That's coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. We've spent much of the program talking about taxes here in the U.S., and there's plenty to complain about. But if you thought it was tough keeping track of your receipts here, at least you don't have to suffer through the game they play in China. Our China Bureau Chief Scott Tong sent this non-appreciation from his office in Shanghai.
Every day here, the sun rises, the earth turns, and a fax arrives from the tax evasion industry. It's unsolicited spam, offering government-approved receipts, a key ingredient to cook your books. The fax reads, "Dear sir, our company has legitimate receipts for sale. Please call." So I do, and ask, how much do these receipts cost? Seller says 1%. That is, if I want a receipt showing I've spent $100 on something, it costs me $1.
If you want a receipt for meals, we can make it out to be from a restaurant, or if you want a construction company or advertising company.
Here's the tax cheating part. I take the receipts, file bogus expense reports at work, and get massive reimbursement. My boss, who's in on the scam, knows I've been reimbursed and only pays me a teeny tiny salary, which means I only pay teeny tiny income taxes. When I take in a meal with local Chinese workers, hang out with them, I realize everyone does this kind of thing. One friend notes that China's national sport isn't soccer, it's tax evasion. Office worker Wang Haiyan says most of her income is off the books.
In my contract, I make about $400 a month, but I use receipts to get another $700, sometimes $1,000.
There are variations to this game, perhaps only limited by one's imagination. But the key in China is employers are in on it. They're liable if workers cheat the tax man. CPA Hank Berg works for a Shanghai consultancy, Dizan Shira.
Your typical Chinese business keeps multiple sets of books. So you have the official one that they show to the government. They have the ones that they're willing to show any partners. And then they have the third one that's the real one because they have to manage their business.
He says what makes all this possible is the tax enforcers are
a little bit behind in their sophistication, but rapidly closing the ranks. And what that means is that there probably is an awful lot of people here that are exploiting that lack of sophistication.
Now, why do folks cheat on their taxes? Perhaps an obvious question, but many here say it's because tax rates are so high, especially for the wealthy.
The U.S. currently, I believe, tops out around 28%. In China, it tops out at 45%.
The lowest bracket is 5% for persons making just above $300 a month or $3,600 a year. And unlike the U.S., you can't write off things like mortgage interest or doctor costs or college prepayments. China's tax code doesn't reward those behaviors the way America's does. Nor does it wait for citizens to do the right thing every April 15th. Every so often, my office colleague Cecilia Chen gets a call from the local tax bureau. Individuals here have to pay their taxes every month. And if they're overdue or almost overdue, they get a call at the office. Our Shanghai friend Wang Haiyin works hard to keep her local tax collectors happy.
We give them shopping gift cards four times a year for $25 or $75. Otherwise, they'll watch me like a hawk. And if we start to get in any kind of trouble, we give them money.
Or sometimes the tax collectors drop a hint. Again, accountant Hank Berg.
Not all of them are honest. You know, there is a lot of corruption in the Chinese system. They, you know, sometimes will request special payments.
To put this corruption in perspective, Berg notes that this kind of thing happens all around the world. And China is not even considered one of the dirtier places. By one estimate, it's 79th cleanest out of 180 countries measured. And in their defense, Chinese taxpayers often say they keep money from government coffers because they're not even sure the money would even go to government coffers. Here's a few comments from China's blogosphere.
Where's my tax money go? I demand to know if it goes to politicians and their so-called overseas study tours.
You know what civil servants are for? To eat, drink, and schmooze with our money.
Perhaps that's the big difference between here and the U.S. The American taxpayer is skeptical of government waste. The Chinese taxpayer is skeptical of government fraud. In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace Money.
We are back to learn more about your life with dollar signs, and our economics editor, Chris Farrell, is here with me. And, you know, Chris, a little bit ago, we talked to a listener that had some really good financial habits, James.
Yes.
Good amount of savings, healthy investments. But our next guest, he's flying high for a different reason. Joe is calling from San Clemente, California. Hi, Joe.
Hey, how are you guys?
Doing all right. So, San Clemente, you're right there on the coast.
You know it. Barely even made it to the phone call. Surf was good, so.
All right. But I understand that you're not just about surfboards, you're about snowboards, too.
For sure.
What do you do?
I work for Oakley Sports Marketing, and I spend most of my days out on a snowboard hill hanging with the Halfpipe Riders.
The Halfpipe Riders. We saw those in spades up in Vancouver.
Yeah, you saw some of our guys, specifically Sean White is one of the dudes that we work really closely with and hang with all the time. So it's pretty cool being up in Vancouver with him and watching him do what he does.
Oh, that must have been fun. You know, our producer knew about this before we got on the phone with you, and we decided to get a little clip of that and have a little fun here.
Cool.
Huge straight air for Sean, setting the momentum for the rest of his run. Massive double cork. Sean's moves right now are so much higher than the other riders. This is unbelievable.
All right, a massive double cork. So how can we relate this to personal finance?
Well, the way I've been thinking about this is where you're confused with the snowboard stuff, I am completely confused with the finance stuff. So.
Uh-oh. Well, tell us a little bit about your financial situation.
I'm 26, you know, relatively young, but been in the workplace for a little bit. You know, oh, cool, somebody pays me to do something, get a little bit of savings, and built a little bit of a 401k, recently switched jobs, and kind of have had to finally look at what I have. And so I was like, whoa, I have a 401k, an IRA, a Roth IRA, a CD. And I'm like, what do I even do with this stuff?
Well, first of all, I mean, your buddy Sean White might have won the gold at Vancouver, but I think you should win the Marketplace Money Gold for personal finance. You're 26, and you already are getting all kinds of retirement money ready for yourself. That's fantastic.
I don't want to work that hard.
But while you are working hard, you're putting some aside.
I'm trying to, yeah.
That's fantastic. So it sounds like you have a bunch of different accounts, though.
Yeah, I have a bunch of different accounts. And so I'm wondering, what do I really need to do to make sure that I am actually on track for some sort of financial planning? Because it sure doesn't feel like I'm planning for anything.
Well, Chris, let's start out with all these different accounts. And I think this is a common thing for people where they have, you know, a Roth here, another IRA there, a 401k here, a 403b there. And you wonder what you're supposed to do with all that.
Right. Well, let's keep doing the 401k. You say you have a new employer and a new 401k?
Well, yeah, my new 401k won't kick in for another 7 months. So right now I've got the old one. I haven't done anything with it. It's just kind of sitting there, but it did relatively well in the last 2 years. So I haven't rolled it over into anything. I just literally was like, I'm going to just leave it.
You know, what I'd look at is, do you want to roll it over into your new 401k, which you can probably do, or you can roll it over into an IRA, what we call a rollover IRA. And this way you just keep it, it keeps growing and it's tax deferred and all the shelter is going on there. But, you know, most people are managing a 401k, a Roth, and then you have your savings account with the CD. And, you know, over time, that's okay. It's pretty hard to get it below that.
Okay. So it feels good to hear that, but yeah. I'm still confused. Like, should I, like, be daily looking at this stuff? I mean, like, if I roll my 401k into any of this, like, new stuff or my new employer's 401k, will that change the investments that it's currently in? Because my IRAs did terrible last year, and my 401k did incredible.
Yeah, but remember, you're 26 years old, and this is money for when you're 60, 65, 70 years old. You have a long time.
Long way to go.
Yes.
Long way to go. So, but you do want to look at it when, you know, you're making your transition. So when you're opening a new plan, you're going to have to look at it, well, where do I want the money to go? I would lean toward, you know, if you're looking, say, a stock portion of it, you know, you just go for something that's really owns just a lot of stock. You know, you're not trying to go into mid cap and small cap and large cap and growth and value and all, because you want to be surfing, you want to be snowboarding. That's what you want to spend your time on. That's what you want to be smart about, right? So
yeah, exactly.
You go for really broad based stuff. So I have a couple suggestions, and one that might really help you out and some other people. There's this financial planning network. It's called Garrett Planning Network. They're online, and what they do, they're fee only. You sit down with a certified financial planner and you pay a fee, and you just literally say, okay, here's what I got. Let's talk about what are my options, what are my choices, what am I doing? They're going to tell you just as tested as I'm saying, you're doing great, but they'll give you some really concrete advice.
Okay, cool. And then I was hoping you guys could help me with one other quick question too. My mom was really getting on me, and she's like, she wants to know whether it makes financial sense for me to buy a motorcycle. She said, we'll let you guys decide it.
You're calling us for permission? Is that it?
That's what I'm calling you for.
I could just take a look at the price of insurance. Get out. That gives your answer right there. Yeah, there
all right.
What's your ride now?
I have a 2007 Jeep that's worth absolutely nothing.
Well, but it's paid off.
No. Not even close.
Oh, it's no. Oh.
No, it's a new car.
And so why do you need a motorcycle?
Oh, because it's sweet.
Yeah.
Yes. This is Joe School of personal finance. I like this. Yes, I mean, I want it, so I'm going to buy it.
Exactly.
All right. Well, I guess we'll look forward to maybe seeing you in the Summer Surfing Olympics.
Possibly.
All right.
Cool. Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Well, thanks for the call.
Bye.
All right, dudes. If you've got a financial question, send it to us. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Actually, you can't send it to us there. That's a phone call. But if you do want to send it to us, then write to us. You'll find the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. Chris, I'll see you on the beach, man.
Sweet.
And remember to check with your financial professional before you make any big money decisions. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
I know why they invented the tax form.
Commentator Harriet Brackey.
Let's face it, you wouldn't deal with this stuff any other way. The IRS is breathing down your neck. Get going. I mean, a tax form is like a to-do list for your personal finances that you can't put off. You have to look at it, and usually you're going to feel some pain. Good, I say. Look at it and suffer, and vow to get things in order in the future. No one likes taxes, but honestly, I don't mind them. Everything fits somewhere, unlike in the rest of your life. You can write off things as large as a circus elephant or as small as what I'm putting into my retirement account these days. You match the list of tax breaks to your life's expenses. Paid for the kids' worthless college tuition? Check. That could be a deduction. Didn't get paid back on the loan to your worthless brother-in-law? Check. That could be one, too. Didn't get to cash out of that big bank stock before it went belly up? Check. They have thought of everything. I'm telling you, you might as well just submit. Your whole life is going to be reflected in your tax form somehow. But unlike in life, all these decisions you made last year, at least on your tax return, come to a conclusion nice and neat. You add it all up, look down at the bottom, and you owe something or they owe you. It's one or the other. For ordinary people, taxes are the annual whack upside of the head. It says, hey, you gonna be smart or what? You gonna save for retirement and take the deduction or what? Will you make some tax-advantaged moves that are actually smooth or not? Which is it? The tax form demands an answer. Now, one final piece of advice. If you start bragging about what a cool tax-saving dude you are, and look here at this nifty little deduction you've found, I guarantee you it'll take the buzz out of date night. Don't do it. Don't brag about your taxes. Just get them done.
Harriet Brackey writes a personal finance column for the Florida Sun Sentinel. Now, who among us hasn't stopped in the middle of doing our taxes, fallen to our knees, and prayed to a higher power just to make it all go away? I'm not sure it's ever worked. If it has, we'd love to hear that story. Meanwhile, maybe you could find someone willing to do your taxes for you who answers to a higher power. We did.
My name is Nakia Robert. I am a minister at First African Methodist Episcopal Church, Bethel, in Harlem, New York, and I'm also a tax preparer. I've been doing taxes for 8 years. You might want to say 9 if you include the year out of college where I started preparing my mother's tax returns. I've been in ordained ministry for 5 years. I spent 6 years on Wall Street, starting with Arthur Andersen straight out of college, culminated my career at Citigroup with their investment bank. And so I left there to pursue a call to ministry. So I completely left Wall Street, perhaps just in time. My responsibilities in both jobs are huge, overwhelmingly. People have to be able to trust you. Trust is a major, major issue in taxation. And, you know, I find a lot of my clients have gained a mistrust towards tax preparers because of the larger franchises. And I'm happy to say that of all the years that I've been doing taxes, not one of my tax clients has ever been audited. And I'd like to think that's because an example of best practices and that preparing tax returns in a way that flags aren't being raised with the IRS auditors. Well, now that it's tax season, my schedule is quite crazy, as you can imagine. I get tax returns around January through April. I try to extend the courtesy to my clients to be as accessible as possible just to maintain my competitive edge. So I try to make myself accessible on weekends. I do work after hours. So right now I'm playing catch up. My daughter was baptized this weekend, and so I have a client who told me he's going out of town tomorrow. And so immediately after this interview, I'm headed to my P.O. box to pick up his documents. To balance the life between a minister and a tax preparer isn't as polar opposite as it seems. This is the famous parable in the Bible. I'm looking at Mark 12. And so you have some Pharisees who are questioning Jesus. And if I may, is it lawful to pay taxes to the emperor or not? But knowing their hypocrisy, he said to them, "Why are you putting me to the test? Bring me a denarius and let me see it." And they brought one. Then he said to them, "Whose head is this and whose title?" They answered, "The emperor's." Jesus said to them, "Give to the emperor the things that are the emperor's, and to God the things that are God's." And they were utterly amazed at him. I guess that's the advice I would give to my clients. Unfortunately, we have to give unto Caesar what is Caesar's, and that means paying your taxes.
That was tax preparer Nakia Robert. Sally Herships produced her story. And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, if you make $100,000 a year, are you rich? What if you make $250,000 a year? What if you make $5 million a year? Are you rich? Believe it or not, some people would say no.
Society's definition of being rich has really sort of shifted. He with the largest house, the largest yacht, the biggest plane wins and is therefore rich.
Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman and Eve Tro. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, offering advisors and clients a range of retirement savings solutions. Is a Roth IRA conversion right for you? You can talk to your advisor and evaluate your options at RothIRAblog.com.
American Public Media.